Welcome back, everybody, to the Classic Rock Podcast for this video extra edition. And coming up, we're going to be talking to Dion DeMucci. Now, this is the full video interview that we did with Dion a couple of weeks ago from his home in New York City. And we're going to be looking back at this incredible seven-decade career as a recording artist, as well as delving deep into the brand new album. It is called Girlfriends, and it's this lavish collaborative works involving some of the finest female guitar and vocal talent that is out there. The likes of Patti Schiaffola, Joanne Shaw, Taylor, Susan Tedeschi, they're all involved. To begin with, though, we're going to be looking ahead to next week's show when I'm going to be joined by Status Quo's John Rhino Edwards. He's got a new album out to talk about. It is called Just Sane, and it too is a collaborative affair with some of the friends, acquaintances, and family that he has been working with over the last 40 years, which means, obviously, Francis Rossi is going to be involved, as indeed are the boys from Muse. But we start, though, with an answer to the question which is being posed by a lot of Quo fans this year, if you're across social media: is this the last year of Quo as a live act? And that's how we began. So I asked John Rhino Edwards, is there or are there any imminent plans of a Quo retirement, or is it just simply hearsay? And this is what he had to say.
Anyway, back to Quo. I digress.
Yeah, no, the day job.
Yes.
The mothership.
Yeah.
So let's put something to bed here. There's a lot of chatter, right, on social media, on the, you know, the numerous Quo fan pages on Facebook and Instagram, of which there are hundreds of thousands of members. And they're all talking about, well, I mean, you know, this is the year you got to get to see him because it's going to be the last. It's going to be, you know, the goodbye is coming and whatever. But we aren't ready yet, are we, for a Quo-less world? There's no
Quo-less
sign of imminent. yeah, Quo-less world. There's no imminent plan of retirement.
We're doing this year. A lot of it depends on what Francis wants to do, obviously, and I don't know. I know. And this is really truthfully, unfortunately, I couldn't get to see his show this time. And I wasn't really that bothered about seeing the other two because I didn't think it would tell me anything that I didn't already know. And I'm really peeved that I didn't go to see this one. It just didn't pan out that when Francis was in 50 miles of me, that I couldn't get to go once. I know he's really, really enjoyed that. I believe, you know, I mean, I saw him the other week. We did an advert for Marks and Spencer's, and I hadn't seen him for nearly 2 years, although we'd spoken. And it was, you know, when we got back together again, the vibe was just there straight away. You know, it was really good fun again, and everyone was very happy to see everybody. So I'm not beating about the bush, but I think there'll be a decision made at the end of the year, you know, probably by Francis. I mean, but Andrew will be nearly 80 by then. So the answer is I'm not giving you any answer. I think that's, but no, because we don't know either. You know, it might well be that we finish these shows that, yeah, that's enough, we're done with this, you know. But then when my Freddie started playing with us for a while, when Rick got sick, that was going to be it. You know, the last night of the Electrics. And a combination of Freddie doing it. Freddie, I know when Freddie left, I couldn't believe, what do you mean you're leaving? How dare you? You know, I think he's definitely the only person who's ever left this band. And then, you know, and then when Richie came along, you know, it was all, oh, this is good. We're enjoying this.
But the thing is, people only usually talk about retirement and stopping if they can't do it anymore. The product that they're putting out isn't any good. And that's not the case in either of those situations. Because, I mean, you know, if you go see the band, I saw them, I don't know, 18 months ago or whatever, still seem top of the game to me.
We're still singing songs in the original keys, pretty much all of them. Like the only one, I sing Rain in a... I cheerfully murder Rain. in a lower key to Rick only because I couldn't do it. That I couldn't murder it in the right key. I had to murder it in the wrong key. I love singing that song, by the way. So up yours if you think I murder it. Not you. we sort of the songs in the original keys, which a lot of bands don't. I mean, I checked out a few people, like, you know, Guns N' Roses, they're all down a semitonal, or a tone, in fact, now. So many bands, what do they call them? Heritage acts are tuning down because the singer can't cut it. I mean, Francis is in incredible shape. He really, not even for his age, he's just in really good, you know, he really takes care of himself.
I love those little videos, those little cameo videos he was putting out at the stops on his talking tour, usually in restaurants, eating food.
No, it's great. It's real.
Right. What about then, next thing, an album? So will there be another album? I mean, if you look back to Backbone.
No,
definitely not.
I don't think so. I think that it's a question of whether we can be asked or not. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, there's always, you know, I don't know about the writing material side of things, but it's diminishing returns these days.
You know,
One must remember that people would put out an album and then go on tour to promote the album. And now people put out albums to promote a tour. You know, it's a lot of work. That put it like this: if we were, for me, I'd rather do another tour than another album. You know, it's so much work, and it's not work. I mean, I don't get me wrong. I really enjoyed making Backbone. It was a real pleasure for me. But Francis had, you know, I sort of chipped in. Francis had to do a heck of a lot of work on that, and I just, you know. Well, we all put in the work, but it's whether, I'd rather do gigs than do another album, for me.
It's a shame, because the album was great. It was the highest charting album since you've joined. In the Army Now, I think, got to number 7, but this one got to number 6. And there were some great tracks on that album. You know, and you actually did something which was very unusual. At that time, you actually played the tracks live before the album was released.
We've only ever done that once before. We did that on Heavy Traffic. We played two songs, one called All Stand Up and one called Solid Gold. That was very interesting, actually, because we'd recorded them. And then we went out and played them live. And then we re-recorded them for the album, and they were so much better, which is obviously the case, but... Quote's not never been that kind of a band, really. You know, some bands go out and they, like comics, if you like, they blood their, you know, they blood the new material before they commit it.
I just go on that retirement thing. One of your great quotes was, we have set a date for splitting the band up. It's April the 3rd, 2034.
Well, you know, I mean, I love what B.B. King said. They said, so B.B., when are you going to retire? He said, about 8 years after I'm dead.
Dead. Here we are about to welcome this fourth album that you've put together in 8 years, which is remarkable after 7 decades performing as you have been. And you're arguably in the most productive period of your entire career. So what is the key ingredient, not only to this longevity, but to maintaining the quality of what you do?
Well, Tim, I think underneath it all, I've been clean and sober for like 55 years. I talked to Eric Clapton about this, and I think that has a lot to do with it, because back in 1968, I was living in chaos, and I don't know if I would have made it through my 20s. So I just put down the cigarettes, the drugs, the alcohol in 1968, and I haven't looked back. So I think that has a lot to do with you know, clarity of my mind and my body. And, you know, I went into like a spiritual 12-step based program. And I think it really helped my life a lot because I've been married 60 years. I have three daughters. I'm a grateful guy and I'm relaxed, you know. So the, you know, I hate to say this because I know how difficult the lockdown was for a lot of people. There was agony and misery through it, but it was one of the best times of my life. I became so creative. I couldn't go anywhere. You know, we were like, like in our houses. So I wrote, I was writing the best songs of my life. I seemed like I stepped under the spout where the glory comes out or under the wellspring of creativity. And these songs just start flowing. And one day Joe Bonamassa came over. He said, I want to play on that. And that started it because I know how to record a good, I know how to make a record. I know how to make a good record. I want to transmit this enchantment to people. I want to, you know, this delight. I want people to go, oh, yeah. So I try to make one of those records. But to have a guy like Joe Bonamassa play, you know, I found out how limited I am because I don't think in those terms, you know, I didn't even think of a slide guitar player on Blues Coming On. And then Take It Back, the way Joe plays. And then I thought, this is a great idea. I'm going to ask artists to contribute to my songs. I'm going to make the record. I'm going to send it because I listen to a lot of music. And someone sitting in my truck listening to what I've done, you know, new songs are recorded and the tracks with the musicians, I'm thinking, Mark Knopfler would sound good on this. Hey, you know, Susan Tedeschi would sound good on this, you know. So I just, or Sonny Landreth, you know. And so that's what I've been into. It's been a very, very creative time in my life. Thanks for noticing because I'll tell you one other thing. I don't know. This is crazy. I've always been on somebody else's schedule. So making albums were like pulling teeth or agony at times because I was always waiting for somebody to stop talking for 30 minutes and having to do this, you know, and I had to get ready when everybody else was ready. This isn't like that. I'm doing it on my terms and I'm ready. I'd sing the song. And it's just been wonderful. I've had a great time. It's like a lot of fun doing these albums, I'll tell you.
You said previously that you didn't pick the collaborators before the song is done. You write it and then you think, I think I'd like to hear them on it. Now, is Girlfriends different? Did you write this specifically with the cast list in mind?
No, same thing. I wanted, you know, the way I think of it is I want to write a great song. You know, the blues genre is just very guitar driven. I mean, it's all about guitar. You know, it's a lot of guitars, and which I love. That's why I'm in it. I just love guitars. Right? So there's nothing wrong with that. But I wanted to, you know, maybe contribute something a little different with the lyrics. You know, like for instance, I had this word. Well, let me tell you that when I had this word soul force. So I said, I'm going to write a song about this because these girls that I wanted to do an album with women because I had a great time on Blues with Friends and Stomping Ground, the last two albums. I had a great time with Samantha Fish and I had a great time with Ricky Lee Jones. I just loved working with the girls. It was a lot of fun. And there's something about when a beautiful girl walks in the room who's talented, the atmosphere totally changes. You know, it just totally changes. So it's the feminine genius, you know. So I thought, I'm going to write these songs. I'm going to come up with a concept. And I And you know, I start out strong, you know, like I thought that I could dazzle by distraction. And how could she resist my kind of action? You know, and I end up strong with the concept. And I wanted to write every song like that. And so I got my friend Mike Aquilina to help me out. And we honed out these songs. And you're right. What I do is, let me put this light on so I can see. Hi. I get these songs, and you're right. I finish them off. I sing the whole thing. And some I had where they were conversational, you know, like sitting across the table talking to somebody or the phone or together. But I didn't want to like make it boring. So I changed it up a bit. Some girls played guitar, like Susan Tedeschi on Soul Force. She killed it. She played guitar, you know. My only regret is, and we both agreed on this, somewhere in the future, we're going to sing together because I just love the way she sings. I love the way she sings. But you're right. I finished the song, and when I'm listening to it, I'm thinking, Rory Block belongs on this song, or Christine Ullman, because I know these people. And I know what they're capable of doing and how much information and beauty and truth and good music is in their head. You know, like a girl like Christine Ullman, she is steeped in the history of rhythm and blues. So when you give her a song, she just kind of just gets inside of it. And gives you herself, you know, and you don't have to tell any. I never told any of these girls anything to do.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, do you find now that you are almost sat at the head of the table, right? You're the one that others will maybe come to for inspiration, maybe for guidance or to share thoughts. And if you are the one that is getting in contact with them, there is no shortage of people that are just like, are you kidding? Absolutely. I'm there. What time? You know, everybody wants to come and be involved. It's almost like, and I don't like using this sort of this term, but I do think it fits. You are the godfather. Yeah, you are a man sat at the table and people are being brought into the room and say, I have a song for you.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I was like, I never felt like that, but never. I mean, I would
kind of like it now because
that would feel insane to feel like that. I always feel, you know, because I'm calling up these great musicians, you know, but I'll tell you, I get such a wonderful response, especially from Eric Clapton, who he said, you know, you were one of the guys who got me into this, you know, And when he, you know, Tim, this is very strange. The people I ask to play on my songs, sometimes I think they play better on my songs than they do on their own.
I like it. You talked about the feminine genius on every track here, but you also have gone into the significant influence of women in your life, beginning, you know, with your mother, whose influence loomed large over the whole family, your sisters, your daughters. There has always been the influence of women around you.
Oh yeah, my mother was you know, she was the hub of the family. She had two jobs and she was a strong woman. She just worked hard. She was a worker, you know. And then I have two sisters, and then I got married to Susan Butterfield, who kind of saved my life in a way because I was a train wreck. And we have three daughters. And so I always had a lot of women around me. And I have four granddaughters. And so it's just, you know, and I say this, there's a friend of mine who talks about the feminine genius. And I thought, wow, he put a name to it. That's what it is. And it is. It's just, and sometimes they don't have to say a word, you know. It's just incredible to have finished this album with these women. It was just, it was really, it's a lot of fun, you know. I did a song with Rory Block called "Don't You Want a Man Like Me?" Because, it, you know, in the blues genre, there's a thing I call bragging rights. You know, I'm a man. I'm the hoochie coochie man, the wanderer, king of the New York street. You know, these bragging rights. You know, I just love it because they're over the top. You know, mannish boy, but Muddy Waters. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I wrote this song called "Don't You Want a Man Like Me?" You know, the kid is here. You know, so she's, Rory Block is a wonderful blues artist. Another one who is so steeped in the blues. She has so much to draw on, you know. So she gave it her all. She comes in the studio and she does this incredible, you know, just contribution to, you know, delivery. And her husband comes out of the booth. He says, "Dion, don't play this for your wife. You get in trouble." You know, because, I mean, she sounds like Meg Ryan in, what was it,
Harry Met Sally.
Yeah, when it's like, what is she? I'll have what she's having, you know.
In the notes of the album, Darling Doves, talking about the influence you had. Again, this is another part of this, these people queuing up to lavish praise. Yeah, you heard about what Eric Clapton said. She was saying that you're part of my musical upbringing. Clapton was talking about, you know, my musical wake up. I mean, again, when you read these things, how much of not inspiration, but how good does it make you feel to know that you've had this influence?
You hit something. It's something very personal there and very deep inside me, and it sounds almost trite to talk about, but let me try to put it together. I'm glad I lived this long because I've never asked for help. And when I started asking people to join me and they were happy to do so, Tim, it made me feel so good. I can't tell you. I grew up in a world where I thought you should never ask for help. It's, you know, my mother had such pride. Don't ask anybody for help. You know, you got to do it yourself, that kind of thing. You know, you got to earn
it.
You gotta, all this pride, you know. So I started asking for help, and it was amazing. I sent the song to Patti Scialfa and Bruce Springsteen because I love the way Patti Scialfa is the Jersey soul girl, man. So I send her this track called "Angel in the Alleyways," and she sends me back, I think it was about 48 tracks, and I forgot. But it was numerous tracks. It could have been more. But because this was the only song I sent out just with my guitar, just with the guitar. There was no bass, no drums, no nothing. I thought she was going to do harmony, and I wanted her to hear it very clearly, what I was doing. But she ended up designing and producing the song, and every verse is different. And so when you get something like that back from Bruce and Patti, it's almost embarrassing to say, man, but you feel loved. You feel like, you know, wow, they really gave me time. You know, it wasn't like with Eric Clapton, the same thing when he played on If You Want to Rock and Roll, the song is called. I called him up. I said, "Eric, you sound 19 years old on this song. Dion
standing up, he said, didn't he?
Yeah, he said, I stood up. And I took that up like he really wanted to do a good job, and he did. You know, he wanted to put effort into it.
But you know what? If you're ever having a bad day, or you wake up and you're just not feeling great, all you've got to do is look down the list, really, haven't you? I mean, Bruce Springsteen was talking about you being the real link between, or the only link between, Sinatra, rock and roll, and the blues. Lou Reed, of course, talking about your voice, saying, "Listen, once I heard it, it was in my head forever." But I think the greatest quote was from Bob Dylan, wasn't it, when he said that, you know, your voice takes its color from all palettes. He's never lost it, and his genius has never deserted him.
Yeah, I Bob Dylan complimented my songwriting. I thought, wow, I'll take that. Yeah, it, you know, what could I say, Tim? It makes you feel good. And that's a beautiful thing, you know.
Too.
You know, life is about giving. You know, I'm not saying there's not a place, you know, there's a time to say no, but I've just been overwhelmed with, these last three albums, the friends I've made. You know, I never really had many conversations with Mark Knopfler or Peter Frampton.
Oh, and yeah.
I became like friends with these guys. Are great guys. I mean, not a talented, and it's humbling. They are so humble. You know, they're like so unassuming. You know, and they're Mark Knopfler was all in, like wanted to help. So it was fun working with him, you know, and I love his sound. It's just, I was just so overwhelmed by that, you know.
I know that Van Morrison's involvement with the Friends album was the first time you said in 57, 58 years that you'd impressed your wife. What did she think of Girlfriends?
Well, you know, she loves the songs, and she knows some of these girls, and she just gets so happy to hear us, you know, collaborating together, like Debbie Davies and Christine Ohman and you know, Rory Block, and some of these girls, you know, I've been fans forever, like Sue Foley. So Susan is like, she's happy for me, you know. She's like part of it, you know.
You did mention that when guys, musicians, it doesn't actually have to be in music. Whenever you get into a room and there's women there, there is a different vibe. Men are different creatures. Is there just the obvious, simple reason for that?
Well, on some level, maybe, you know, but my friend, my co-producer, Wayne Hood, he's married to a beautiful girl, a singer, blonde, tall, gorgeous girl. And when I wrote the liner notes to this album, and I call them the feminine genius, he said to me, "Dion, I know exactly what you're talking about." He says, When I walk into a rehearsal hall with musicians alone, but when I walk in with Aaron, my wife, the whole room changes. He says the room changes. So I know exactly what you mean. He said, at some level, I think we're all trying to impress, you know, or like get their attention, or, you know, at some level, you know, it's amazing.
This love of the blues, which when I look and listen to interviews you've done in the past, I'm amazed. It still surprises some people. They're like, oh, you've done a blues album. But this has been a lifetime's dedication. After those early years when you were listening to Louis Prima, I'm trying to imagine the scene. It's like a nighttime radio. Radio is a big thing then, isn't it? You're in your bedroom, you've got your transistor radio on, and you've got this radio station in Virginia pumping out blues. And what was it? Hank Williams, Honky Tonk Blues, and then Jimmy Reed, Baby, What You Want Me to Do. These were the moments that were defining moments for you as a kid. This is what hooked you in.
Absolutely. Tim, I don't think I've ever changed. I think I'm pretty easy to understand. Because when I was, 11, 12, when I heard Hank Williams, I never heard any, I'm from Bronx, New York City. Nobody listened to country music in Bronx, New York. I didn't know what jambalaya meant in the 50s, honky tonk blues. I had no idea even what it meant. So I got hooked on Hank Williams. I started collecting his records. When I went on tour with Buddy Holly, I was playing him the backsides of Hank Williams' 78s. And he didn't even know what they were. I knew about 40 Hank Williams songs by the time I got on tour with Buddy Holly. So, then I heard Jimmy Reed. So I always say I wanted to communicate like Hank Williams and write like him if I could. hot. The golden standard there. But I wanted to communicate like Hank Williams and roll like Jimmy Reed. And
you had a record shop, didn't you, just up the block, a place called Cousins.
Yeah.
Which was run by a guy called Lou Cicchetti, who you got to know me. And the guy would call you, wouldn't he, whenever there's anything you thought that you'd like. He'd say, hey, you got to come listen to this, and you'd be straight up there.
Well, I don't know if he thought but he would call me whenever a new Hank Williams record came out or a new Jimmy Reed record came out. He would get it for me, and I would run up there, and yeah, he took a liking to me. But Tim, all my life I've been trying to transmit the feeling that Jimmy Reed and Hank Williams gave me as a kid in here. I wanted to design something and put something together physically, so I could transmit it to others. All my life, I'm still doing that. All these years, it's just a passion,
Yeah.
Because it took me into a place that we don't experience on this level. It took me to transcendence. It took me to a higher reality, a place that of delight and pleasure and enchantment that I don't experience on this level. So, it stayed with me, it got me on a road, and that's what I'm all about. No matter what.
71 years, I reckon, if the dates are right, 71 years since you got up on the stage at, Maguire Dix Lakehurst Army Base, Fort Dix, as they called it, and you did Cold Cold Heart, Jambalaya and Hey Good Looking. And at the end of the night, You got a guy with a great name, by the way. Was it Yodie Bart gave you $20, and you're like, "Well, I got to do this for my life. This is what is this? I've sung three songs, and I've earned more money than my dad makes."
Well, my parents were paying $36 a month rent, and they were arguing every day about getting it together. Because my mother made, because back then when I first went on tour with Bobby Darin, my first tour, or I would say 1959 with Buddy Holly, I remember that firemen and policemen made about $80. They were highly paid. They were paid good. Well, they were paid about $80 back then a week. So I was making much more than that a week, So I was like, nobody in my family ever won like that. But yeah, it really, that motivated, that felt good. But it was never for the money. I never really got, hey, I should go there for, it was always about the music. It's always about the song. When the song is right, the whole band is good looking. When the song right, nobody even cares.
Did the real career directional change come that day that you sat with Aretha Franklin at the piano when John Hammond comes over and says, hey, you got to listen to this, and handed you that stack of Robert Johnson records.
Yeah, you know, I was recording at Columbia, and John Hammond's office was maybe 5 feet away from the door that, you know, Bob Mercy used to record Aretha and myself when we were very young. You know, I was the first rock and roll assigned to Columbia Records, and she was there, and they were giving her a lot of Al Jolson songs, you know. So I got on the piano and started playing Drip Drop, and John Hammond across the way came in, and he said, you really have a flair for the blues. So I've been doing it since back then, but it never connected where it just never connected until about 20 years ago when I was being interviewed by Terry Gross for NPR. And I was punctuating my story with some of the songs I grew up with. And a friend in New York heard me and he said, Dion, you got to do a blues album. And I did. It was called Bronx and Blue.
Yeah, yeah. That got Grammy nomination, didn't it?
Just with my guitar. I did it in 2 days. And when I played that record in my truck, I thought, oh my God, this comes out of me so easy. I don't even have to think. It's like, it's right in the center of my being. It's like breathing.
Yeah.
I'm not even aware of myself. It just comes out. So I thought, this is really the foundation of everything I've done. You know, and I went, and then, you know, when I look back and I see I was doing Ruby Baby, and even Billy Gibbons told me that. He said, Dion, when I was a kid, he said, I went to the record store. I got Ruby Baby. I got The Wanderer. I got Drip Drop. They're all blues songs. He said, and I even think Run Around Sue is a cleverly disguised blues song. So he was, I just never connected to the genre or the, you know, I was just all over the place.
There was a lot of reluctance initially, wasn't there, to you playing the guitar, especially from the TV and the record company execs in the earlier days. Basically, they were saying, look, lead singers don't play the guitar. Put the guitar down and just sing. You're obviously glad you never took the advice.
it was like that because, you know, I was just looking to make a record. I was looking to just do something creative. And when I got down to this company, they put me with this group that I really didn't like, that, you know, I didn't identify with them. They were older guys, and they were kind of square, you know. And so I said, listen, if you want me to sing with, you know, a group, I'll, you know, get some of my friends in my neighborhood. I'll recruit some guys in my neighborhood. So I did, because I knew guys in my neighborhood used to always hang out near the jukebox and sing harmony and do stuff in the pool room. So I got three guys, and we went down there, and we named ourselves Dion and the Belmonts, and we started out with doo-wop stuff. And I was just trying to make a record, but I kind of lost myself. My love was just getting that guitar and selling a song.
Yeah.
And somewhere in that mix, it got to me. I said, you know, I love doing this. And because they were, you know, talented guys, you know, and friends. And I just had to move on. You know, I wanted to, you know, I had something, I was hearing different stuff in my head, you know.
Your definition of the blues, and it's good to touch on the spiritual aspect, because you said, when asked the question, it's the naked cry of the human heart longing to be in union with God. And I know a lot of people were quite surprised, think, oh, the Bible as a source of the blues. Now, that is interesting. But as you said, everybody in the Bible has got the blues, including God, from having to deal with us every day of the week.
You know, you said it. That's it. And everybody's crying out. You know, if you read the Psalms, you know, they're all crying out to get some peace and connection and union. You know, it's quite remarkable. You know, you say, wow, I'm not alone. You know, people have. I like what Bono says. He says, I'm on an ancient track of wisdom. I said, yeah, I could see that. You know, there's like a thread from way back there. If you could get on it, and make it part of your story. There's a lot of sanity in it. There's a lot of, foundation building and that kind of, it helps get you through life, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, you said when you were growing up that you were quite a weird kid. You loved the music. You also loved reading about God and wanted to know, obviously, why you were here. The answer to the big question: why did that mean so much to you? Why were you seeking that answer at such a very, very young age, when kids are like, you know, girls, music, and fast cars?
Well, that's what it was about to me. You know, Chuck Berry was writing about, you know, school and fast cars, you know, cars. But I was like always kind of philosophical.
Philosophical, yeah, yeah.
It was like, love came to me and I knew it would. And when she kissed me, I was born. Then she said goodbye. And then I knew right away I was born to cry. And I was writing these crazy. And then when I went on tour with Buddy Holly and that fatal plane crash, I remember that I was on that bus the next day thinking, why am I here? Why is there something rather than nothing? Who am I? Where am I going? What's this all about? I was like asking questions. Like, I had more questions. It just unsettled me. You know, I was like, guys, I was so close to these guys for 2 weeks. We were having such a good time. I was 19, very impressionable. So it threw me on this road of searching and just searching, you know, like I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Like
Bob, oh, song title, that
it says, everybody's got a hungry heart. And it comes out of St. Augustine. He said, we're restless until we rest in God. And St. Augustine said something great. He said, when you're singing, it's like praying twice. And I get that because, look, number one, if what I have is a gift, there's got to be a gift giver. So the thing is that when you're using the gift, when you're writing, when you're, you know, doing what, you know, the gift you've been given, we're in the middle. We're connected. We know exactly who we are. You know, when I'm in the middle of that song, it's like I'm roller skating. I'm like, yeah, you know, you know, I get it. It's like praying twice. You're just, your mind and heart are raised to a higher level, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned the Buddy Holly and the plane crash. It's the 65th anniversary, of course, in the first week of February. How does somebody, and we won't go over the story again because it's so well known, we don't need to do that, but how does somebody come to terms with this, especially considering how young you were? And did it turn into basically a lifelong grieving process with that lifelong unanswered question? You know, why me?
Yeah, I don't think I ever really, it just never it never went away, so to speak, until 2009 was the 50th anniversary, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame called me up and said, Dion, we're going to bring a camera down there. We want to hear your story, because we were out at the we were out at the 50th anniversary out in Clear Lake, Iowa, at the Surf Ballroom, and we were listening to people, and nothing made sense. Could you tell us your story from your perspective? So they came down, and I told them the whole story. It's on YouTube. It's
yeah.
I think it's called Buddy Holly, True Story, or Buddy, you know. But they wanted it for the archives for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I went from A to Z. I told them the whole story. No one's ever asked, you know, and who asks, and you sit down and talk for an hour and a half, you know. But this was the first time I did it. And then when I went out with the president of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame at the time, Terry Stewart, and Avery Friedman, who was sitting next to him, he's a lawyer from Cleveland, we went out for lunch. And at lunch, I started crying. It just broke. It was like cathartic, or I don't know the word that you use for that, but I felt like I could breathe finally. You know, for some reason, it put a lot of things at rest. So I was very happy they did that. You know, I never had the opportunity to do that, you know. So it did linger, you know. I miss those guys on a lot of levels. You know, they were just great guys, and great artists and songwriters and brothers and friends. And, I just want to make them proud in what I do, you know.
Yeah.
Someday I'm going to see, in my faith, relationships never end, you know.
Yeah. Mind you, I suppose one quote that you've said in the past fits perfectly, I suppose, into that, where you just said, I just feel like I've had an angel guiding me on a higher reality, which would fit.
Well, I don't know. They say you have a guardian angel. I don't know.
Yeah.
All I know is if I have a guardian angel, he must, 3/4 of the time, he must be going, oh, crap, not this again. Help me out, this guy.
Let's end on a few lighter moments. There's been obviously so many great stories about you down the years, and one of the most asked questions, who was Runaround Sue? Now, firstly, it obviously wasn't your wife. I can't believe anybody who put that out there, because they obviously had never listened to the lyrics if you'd have clocked in one. But there was a great story behind that, wasn't there? Because she, Runaround Sue, with the loose morals, ended up phoning into a radio show you were on one day, and you find out she married a rabbi and had 6 kids. Now, is that a true story?
That is. You know, I don't want to mention her name, but her name didn't rhyme with anything. That is a true story. Thanks for reminding me about that. I forget the guy's name that was interviewing me. He called himself, I don't know, something with the keys.
You must have been sat there thinking, no, this can't be real. She can't be ringing up. She's just actually told everybody who she is.
Yeah, no, you know, she didn't know that. I don't think she knew the song was written about her, but, you know, and I didn't know her that well, but it's a story. You know, she was
great.
She was very close in the neighborhood, you know, and I just thought, you know, her name didn't rhyme with anything. So it the way we wrote it was like that, you know.
And tell me, what happened to Jackie Burns, who obviously was the subject in the Wanderer? He was the Wanderer. So Did he know, first of all, that that song was written about him? Did you ever tell him? And whatever happened to him?
I think he's gone now. You know, he's, I don't think he's, I think he passed away. But Jackie Burns was kind of like a, he was bigger than life. You know, he was, he used to walk down the neighborhood with his tank top and his curls drooped in front of his forehead with his tattoos, Flo and Janie and Rose, you know, and just, you know, he had this gait, you know, this, you know, and he attitude. He was worth the song, you know. But I don't, you want to know, I don't think he ever knew the song was about him, you know.
Bruce Springsteen said about that song that if people get it, if people really get what that song was about, then they'd find out what a man should be. What did he mean? I mean, I know that the lines in the it's basically about going nowhere. It's not a song that glorifies anything, but it's about going nowhere. So what did he mean by that, about what a man should be?
Well, a lot of people think they listen to the verses. You know, it's like, I'm the type of, it's one of those bragging rights songs. It's so over the top. It's ridiculous, you know. I got Flo on my left arm, Mary on my right. Janie is the girl that I'll be with tonight. And when she asks me which one I love the best, I tear open my shirt and I show Rosie on my chest. Yo, I'm the wanderer. And then Springsteen got the lines, I roam from town to town. I go through life without a care. I'm as happy as a clown with my two fists of iron, but I'm going nowhere. And then he goes right back into being a jerk, you know, but he, the wanderer, he for one moment he sees himself, you know, he knows he's going nowhere. And, it's not that happy, you know. Back then, I guess if somebody did it today, they would do it in a much with a different arrangement, not in a major key, you know. But back then, everything had to be happy and up, you know. So, but yeah, he was onto it. He thought if you see yourself accurately, you know, that guy, the wanderer, is a thin veneer of a man.
Yeah,
he's really not. You know, he's not going anywhere. You know, he doesn't have, there's not much to him, you know.
And that line that you mentioned in the song, the two fists of iron, stop, and I'm going nowhere. The I'm going nowhere was very nearly two fists of iron and a bottle of beer, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. You know, I'm glad. Wow, am I glad that radio wouldn't have played it if we said that. Back then in the 50s, if you said bottle of beer, they wouldn't have played it because it was going out to teenagers. Well, what they did is they made me rewrite the line and change it. I think it gave it much more depth, you know, I think it made the song really work for me, you know.
And my favorite quote about you, or one of the favorites, Little Richard's mum. I'm just trying to imagine the scene. She's sitting there and you're in the room and she turns to you and just says, you got soul, son. You can groove. I mean, is that one of your favorite quotes about you?
Well, you know, Little Richard's mother. It's you don't forget stuff like that. You know, She really made me feel good. She was talking about the song Ruby Baby, and she felt I sang it with a lot of soul, you know. And she complimented me, and I was just delighted. I was like, if Little Richard told me, I probably would have forgotten, but his mother told me. See, about women, the feminine genius, you know.
So you like to take people on a trip. You like to write songs that are worth listening to, that spark your imagination. So you've arguably, in these last three albums, produced more in there than you have done for years before. So looking to the future, You know, I mean, obviously it's difficult to predict what's going to happen, but what are your plans? What would you like still to achieve? And I know Bob Dylan might be in there somewhere. A collaboration with him would be good.
Oh God. He's, he's something special. You know, I've always looked at genius as, someone in his particular field, what they're doing and what everybody else is doing. And there's the distance between what they're doing and what everybody else is doing. And with Dylan, he's just remarkable. You know, he's a remarkable person. Some people are born that way. So, I would love to do something with him. You know, it's just, I just think the world of what he does. You know, one of my favorite artists.
Have you already got plans for what's coming next? I mean, are you looking at, or do you not do that? Do you just sort of take every day as, you know?
Tim, we have a play that's going to open on Broadway this year. We're just negotiating for the theater right now. We picked the theater. We finally did. And it opens up in the fall. And we're going in with The Wanderer, the play The Wanderer. And it's got rock and roll street history. It's got action, you know, the gangs, you know, like the Young Sopranos. I talked to a gang when I was a kid. And romance, because I met my wife when I was 16. She was 15, 14, you know. We're still together. I've been married 60 years, so.
How did you do that, by the way? How did that survive? Yeah, I mean, because not only has your career and your singing career survived everything, you've actually had one marriage. I mean, that again is completely unheard of.
You got to ask her. You got to ask her. She's down to earth. You know, she comes from She didn't come from the Bronx, so she's very much close to the earth and close to what's real. And it's always kept me in a beautiful place, you know.
They could always use you as a role model, couldn't they? If this is the way to do it, this is how to have a successful career.
Now, you want to know the truth? If I didn't know me, I'd probably be impressed. But I know me, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I get. Well, you said one. I mean, this was another one of your quotes. If you unzip the top of my head and look inside my brain, you would see a very peaceful place. Married for what, 60 years?
Portal.
Lives in portal. Like good food, love family.
Yeah,
and that's it.
Well, I give a lot of credit to the 12 steps. You know, they gave me a design to live. I didn't have that. I didn't have a design, you know, I didn't have a blueprint, you know, and they're designed to lead you into union with God and to open you up to your creator, which is a very, you know, which is the most courageous thing you can do as a man. Open up. I love open people.